It's my intention every once in a while to bring a different message, to kind of step outside of whatever we're going through, just to kind of sometimes just keep you off balance and come back in and keep the book that we're studying fresh and everything. So it's my intention to do that once in a while. That wasn't my intention this week. I ended up with kidney stones this week, and I actually have a CT scan tomorrow, and we're working through some different things. But with that, and then I was scheduled to be gone at the end of the week, I decided that we would go a different direction this morning, and we would step outside of Mark. So Drew will pick back up in Mark on Wednesday night, and Lord willing, we'll be back on track after that. But today I want to bring you a message from the book of Ecclesiastes, if you'd turn there with me. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and a message that I've entitled, Engage and Worship Carefully. Engage and worship carefully. We're going to be looking at the first 7 verses of Ecclesiastes 5, and I'm going to read that as we begin. Guard your steps as you go to the house of God, and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know what they are doing, that they are doing evil. Do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. For God is in heaven and you are on the earth, therefore let your words be few. For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow and than that you should vow and not pay. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams there are in many words, there is emptiness. Rather fear God. Worship is the highest priority for the believer. And if that is indeed the case, we must have then a right understanding of what worship truly is. A few definitions are worth considering in order to turn our attention toward this all-important priority. Warren Wiersbe says, worship is simply the believer's response of all they are, mind, emotions, will, and body, to what God is and says and does. Certainly worship is a response to God in its most basic sense. Piper expounds upon this when he says, worship is what we were created for. Now, this is the final end of all existence, the worship of God. God created the universe so that it would display the worth of his glory. And he created us so that we would see this glory and reflect it by knowing and loving it with all our heart and soul and mind and strength. However, the most compelling definition, I believe, is a guy, is Peterson. He says this, worship of the living and true God is essentially an engagement with him on the terms that he proposes and in the way that he alone makes possible. We are absolutely to respond to God for who he is and what he has done. We are absolutely to reflect his magnificent glory to the world. We definitely want to proclaim his never-ending worth as a church to the nations. But these things must be done on his terms and by his means alone. Worship is not to be done by reinventing it to make it more appealing to an unregenerate culture. Worship is not to be done by quarantining it to a time of singing 7 words 11 times that are an inch deep and a mile wide theologically. Worship is not a time of crazy dancing, rolling on the floor, and speaking in gibberish. Worship is not simply an emotion we feel when the music is playing and the lights are down low. In fact, worship is not self-centered or self-focused at all, unlike the claims of one particular self-proclaimed preacher. She said, "I just want to encourage every one of us to realize when we obey God, we're not doing it for God." I mean, that's one way to look at it. We're doing it for ourselves because God takes pleasure when we're happy. That's the thing that gives him greatest joy this morning. So I want you to know this morning, just do good for your own self. Do good because God wants you to be happy. When you come to church, when you worship him, you're not doing it for God, really. You're doing it for yourself, because that's what makes God happy. Unfortunately, this woman just voiced what many evangelical churches practice on a weekly basis. This misunderstanding of worship is a climactic problem in the church today. So the question is, how am I to come to God in worship? What are God's terms for me, the worshiper? You see, biblical worship is this. It is humbly bowing ourselves before the King of the universe in complete submission, acknowledging his terms and the means by which exalting him on high and proclaiming his worth is to take place. And those things are all prescribed in his word. And this is where we find ourselves with respect to our text this morning. Ecclesiastes was written by Solomon near the end of his life, and it is a recounting of many of his experiences. There are many themes that are brought to light throughout this book, but two are dominant, and two are the most pertinent to our text in front of us. The first theme that we find in the book of Ecclesiastes that is pertinent is the theme of vanity or nothingness or meaninglessness or worthlessness. This is how Solomon begins the book and is his conclusion to everything in life that is apart from God. It's vanity, it's useless, it's worthless, it's meaningless. We live in a culture that puts this on display. It's becoming quite common for people who our world would consider prominent individuals to take their lives at kind of the climax of their life. A number of years ago, a guy who was a beloved actor to many, Robin Williams, took his own life. And it shocked that world. It shocked that entire acting world and the world at large, really. You know, Robin Williams was known for his humor, obviously, and all the different things that he was in. He was the funny guy. And you question, how could somebody who seemed to enjoy life as much as he portrayed on the screen and had that kind of sense of humor, that ability to laugh at life and those kinds of things, how could that guy come to a place where he takes his own life? And not just a guy who's happy, not just a guy who's full of life, but a guy who has everything, right? Because if you're in that world, you do. You have everything. You have everything the world could possibly throw at you. You have money. You have fame. You have power. You have whatever you want. You're denied nothing. And so the question is asked, well, how in the world would a guy like that, with that kind of supposed personality, come to a place when he's just 60 years old and take his own life? How could that happen? Well, because that's what Solomon is talking about. Because a life lived for the fulfillment of all this world has to offer is a life that is vain. It is a life that is meaningless. It is a life that is worthless. It is a life that cannot find complete satisfaction, no matter what you do. And ever since his suicide, there have been a number of more prominent individuals who have taken their own lives, and people are questioning, why is this happening at the prime of their life? It is because they are seeking this satisfaction in everything the world can offer with the rejection of God. That's Solomon's point in the book of Ecclesiastes, is that a life lived apart from God is meaningless. It is worthless. It will end in disaster. That's his point. And Solomon knows that. Why? Because Solomon lived that. I mean, you look at Solomon's life. He started out extremely well. And then he takes a bad path, which probably indicates during that point in his life, he may have not been a genuine believer. I think Solomon became, I think he was regenerated. I think he came to the Lord at the end of his life. But he lived a very, very bad life of idolatry and adultery and all of this terrible, terrible stuff. And so Solomon understands what he's talking about because he literally at this time was the richest, wealthiest, and most known man on the planet. He literally had it all. I don't know about you, but I find myself once in a while thinking, it'd be nice just to step in those shoes for a day. Oh, not a day, maybe a week. Nah, let's try it. A year would be awesome. Man, you know, the next 20 years would be fantastic. Sometimes I think in my mind, you know, somebody just dropped 50 mil into my bank account. That'd be a good day. Yeah. You know, you find yourself thinking about those kinds of things. This guy, he had it all. There was nothing he didn't have that this world has to offer. And yet his conclusion to life was that apart from God, it's meaningless. It's worthless. And according to our text, worship, one of those elements of life apart from God, is meaningless. And not only that, it will bring judgment. The second theme, which is at the heart of our text and the overall point of the book, and is in contrast to vanity, is the fear of God. At the end of the book, Solomon declares his final conclusion concerning life, right? And I'm sure you've heard these preached on a number of times. This is a great text to preach. In verse 13 and 14, the conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments. Because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act into judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. That's why I think Solomon became a believer. Because that's what he closes with. That was the end of his life. He finally got it. And so if we are going to worship God in the way he deserves and demands, then we must fear him. And in our text, a contrast is clearly portrayed between a fool's worship and a God-fearer's worship, between false worship and true worship. Well, we don't want to worship God as a fool, who we will see is an unbeliever, and we don't want to worship God acting like a fool. Solomon, he provides us in this text with three distinctives of a true God-fearing worshiper. Three distinctives of a true God-fearing worshiper so that we will worship God in a sanctified manner. And the first of those distinctives is this. They are conscientious in their approach to God. A true God-fearing worshiper is conscientious. Try and spell that. There's no way I can do that without spell check. Conscientious in their approach to God. See, one who fears God, one who knows God and is living a life of submission to God will be careful, they will be particular, they will be meticulous rather than haphazard when they come to the house of God. They will come with reverence to God. And this is what Solomon is referencing with regard to the command that he begins with. As you look at verse 1, he commands us to guard our steps as you go to the house of God. Guard your steps, or keep your steps, or watch your steps, in some translations. This word means to give heed to the one in whose presence you are coming into. Well, worship involves approaching a holy, transcendent God who is completely distinct from his creatures and infinitely separated from their sin. So when you are coming to God, you are coming to one who is completely distinct from his creatures and his creation, and one who is infinitely separated from their sin. All who come to worship God must make sure of their motives, that they are coming there to worship God and not their self. The house of God here in our text is the temple. Now, this was the ordained place of worship for the nation of Israel. God's presence was in the temple, and so each time an Israelite was to go to the temple, they were to keep that in mind and act accordingly. that they were indeed going into the house of God. Now, they were to approach that house circumspectly, carefully, thoughtfully. Do you approach the house of God carefully, thoughtfully? As you finish out your Saturday evenings and move into our day of worship, which has been designed by God as Sunday, are you closing out that evening, making sure your mind is set and ready to come in a circumspect manner to the house of an almighty, holy, infinite God? Solomon says, guard your steps. Guard your steps. You remember those who did not approach God circumspectly. You remember the golden calf incident. That they got nervous. 40 days, Moses was gone. Our leader brought us into the wilderness to die. He went up on a mountain. There's a lot of smoke up there. The man can't surely still be alive. Joshua, he's abandoned us. So let's find Aaron. Aaron, we need to worship this God who brought us out of Egypt. And so you need to form him into an image so we can worship him. And so they took all their gold jewelry and all the stuff they pillaged from Egypt that was to be with them and help them along the way, all the stuff that God had given them, and they turned it into a calf. They melted it all down, and Aaron formed this golden calf. And then they participated in worshiping this calf in a very idolatrous and terrible, sexually immoral way, is what that party looked like. And you think about this group of people who had been led out of Egypt. They had been in bondage 400 years, and then they had experienced the Great Red Sea and all that entailed, where God literally opened it up, gave them dry ground, and then shut it on their enemy. And they go to the wilderness knowing that God has been leading them by fire and by cloud. All of these expressions of God in their life, very clear. And then taking their leader up to give him the commandments for how they are to live. And yet they turn away because they decided that they were going to find another means, another way to worship God. So you got to form something, Aaron. You got to make it so we can see him. Where is this God who brought us out of Egypt? Make something. And we all know that the first command that was given was, do not make another image. Do not make an image of God. God is spirit. We are never to form him into an image. And yet they did. And what happened? The calf was destroyed and many people were killed as a result of not coming to God in the way that he prescribed. You have Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10. What a crazy story that is. They were the priests, Aaron's sons. They were set apart unto God to lead Israel in worship. They were the pastors of the day. And yet whatever they did, we're not told what this strange fire was, but whatever it was, which I think was probably they were immoral men and they were living in drunkenness and immorality and they were offering worship to God. I think that's probably what the strange fire was. That's just my opinion. We have no idea to know exactly what it was, but I think that's what it was. And so they offer this strange fire, probably coming to God drunk and no way that he described, no way that he had prescribed in his word. And what happened? Fire came out and completely consumed them. So they didn't come to God carefully. And then the New Testament, remember the establishment of the church? The church was just established on the day of Pentecost. Book of Acts, chapter 2. Peter gave that great sermon. Thousands of people came to Christ. What an amazing time that would have been. You end chapter 4 of the book of Acts with the church like living and sharing all their goods. And there you read chapter 4 in the book of Acts and you're just overwhelmed by the joy and the fellowship that the early church experienced. And you think, man, I wish we had some of that in our day. That's how, when I read the book of the Acts chapter 4, that's what I feel like. And what happens, Acts chapter 5, verse 1? And also at the end of Acts chapter 4, they were selling all their stuff, right? To give their money to one another, to help out those who were poor, and all these different things. They were selling their stuff. It was just what they were doing in the early church. And so those two people at the beginning, Ananias and Sapphira, Acts chapter 5, they came before Peter. They sold a piece of land, and Peter just asked them a question. He said, is this all the money? All they had to tell Peter was, no, we just want to give this portion. They were never commanded to give all the money. That wasn't the command in the early church. Just all they had to say was, nope, here's what we want to give. And yet they said, yeah, this is all of it, having taken some for themselves. And they lied. And Peter said, you didn't lie to me. You lied to the Holy Spirit. And Ananias dies, and they take his body away. Sapphira comes a few hours later, asks the same question. She lies, killed. And people think, whoa. God literally struck people dead? Yeah. It was the early church, and he was establishing things. It was a unique time in the history of the church. And what was the reason they were struck dead? Because they did not guard their steps when they came to the house of God. And God is infinitely holy. Each time we come to worship God in a corporate manner, we are to approach God as holy and be conscientious in our approach. So what does this look like? What does this look like to be conscientious in our approach? Well, this is described in the next phrase. As you look at verse 1 in chapter 5, it says, as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen. Draw near to listen. Draw near or approach should be taken here as a command as well because of its connection with guard. So God-fearing worshipers are to draw near to God for one main purpose. One main purpose. What is that purpose? To listen. To listen. The idea of listening here is not just to physically hear words, you know, like sometimes you may or may not do with your parents. Like my children may or may not do that with me. Or if you get in that conversation with a real talkative person, I mean, it all happens, right? And you're just talking with them, and all of a sudden, you're thinking about, you know, the football game that's coming up or the food you're going to eat. That's just how I think. And, you know, all these different things, and all of a sudden, I've missed the last 45 minutes. Just going. Right? Not that kind of listen. Not just noise going into your ear. We're not coming to the house of God to just have noise coming into our ears and our brains. No, the idea of listening here is not to physically hear words, but rather to listen with the intention of obeying. To listen with the intent to obey. Deuteronomy chapter 5 speaks of this type of hearing in Moses' command to the nation of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 27, he says, go near and hear all that the Lord our God says. Then speak to us all that the Lord our God speaks to you, and we will hear and do it. And then just a few verses down in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, the great Shema, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, and the Lord is one. What's the response to hearing that? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. It was always listening with the intention of obeying. That's what he's talking about here. True worship corporately is coming to hear from God so that we will worship in obedience continually. Now, this is in contrast then to the fool who comes to offer his sacrifice, which is manipulative and self-serving. The sacrifice here is not the emphasis when it's talking about that in verse 1, but rather the condition of the one giving it is the emphasis of verse 1. It says that he is a fool, the sacrifice of fools. A fool in its basic meaning is one who is dull in their mind. But here, and along with the rest of, with the majority of other uses in Ecclesiastes, refers to one who is deceived by sin. So when you see the word fool in Ecclesiastes, you're looking at one who's deceived by sin. He is obstinate. He has a propensity toward wrong choices. He follows a path that leads to destruction and ruin. He is unable to see the proper way or conduct. He has no inclination for wisdom. He thinks he can buy wisdom, according to Proverbs 17. He has no light in understanding, no delight in understanding, according to Proverbs 18. He hates knowledge, according to Proverbs 1. He disregards the fear of the Lord, according to Proverbs 1. And his complacency is destruction, according to Proverbs 1. That's the fool. This is an unbeliever. This is a false worshiper. And the description following confirms this as it explains that this one who offers false worship is unaware of the fact that they are doing it because they are living in a state of not knowing. They are blinded to the reality concerning the truth of who God is. As it says that they do not know that they are doing evil. They're blinded to that reality. There's many fools in the church at large today who are playing church. You see, any person who comes who is not a genuine worshiper of God and is coming to worship in some sort of self-serving manner, and they come into the corporate setting, they are who this text is talking about. They are fools. They are foolish. They have no love for God. They have no desire for Him, and they are playing church. In my dealings with young people over the years, this has been the case in many young people's lives. That they grow up in the church. They attend the worship experiences as they are throughout the week in the different services. But in their heart, they are the guy of chapter 5, verse 1. When they come and offer their quote-unquote worship, they are offering their worship as a fool. They have a wrong view of God. And they are involved in a false sense of worship. There might be some of you in this room who do not fear God. You may not be a genuine believer. And if that's the case, right now you need to repent and submit to Christ. Because you don't want to be the fool of verse 1. However many of you, I would suspect, that are Christians. I've heard many of your testimonies, and I see your lives, and there's a joy, there's a love for Christ, there's a desire to serve, and that's fantastic. But perhaps there are times when you are coming to God's house and you are approaching Him like a fool. Not submissively, but manipulatively or commonly. Perhaps, as one group used to put it, Jesus is just all right with you. Your approach to God must not be casual or uninformed. Consider who it is that you are approaching and the reality that there are specific requirements you must meet to come to Him properly. We come to God on His terms, which are ready to listen and ready to obey. Well, as we consider conscientiously approaching God in His house, we must note a second distinctive of a true God-fearing worshiper, and it is this: a true God-fearing worshiper is secondly cautious in his speech toward God. He is cautious in his speech toward God. Well, as we just saw, our first action toward God is to listen with the intention of being obedient. And now we see in verses 2 and 3 that when we do speak, it needs not to be done in a hasty or impulsive way, but rather in a precise and a reverent way. As he says, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. Why? For God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. So we don't come to God in a hasty or impulsive way or a manipulative way. We come rather with perhaps planning our words to God, thinking through how we are going to address this God who is infinitely holy and infinitely beyond us. You know, if you were going to meet someone who is prominent in our world, you know, perhaps a politician or an athlete or someone who's up there who people know, a famous person, and you knew you were going to have this time where you were going to speak with them, it's quite possible you would plan your words before you go to them, I would think. I didn't. One time, I was at my first Shepherd's Conference, I think it was, and Shepherd's Conference for me is very much like Disneyland. I mean, it's like my favorite time of year, and I love it. The amount of snacks that they have around the campus, and the fact that you can sit and get your shoes shined, you can find coffee at every corner, and then you are just inundated with the best preaching this world has to offer. it is a joyous time in my life. And I started experiencing that from the very first one. And I was there with, I was a youth pastor, a very young youth pastor. And I was with my senior pastor, and we were sitting there in a session, and the guy who was speaking was one of his favorite guys. He had had a huge impact on his life. And so he told me as it was getting over, I'm going to go up and I'm going to tell this guy how much I appreciate him. And I was like, sweet, I'm coming with you. Because, you know, it's my first year. I don't want to just sit in the pew, and I'm not really a lone guy. So I'm coming with you. I'll just hang out. And that was my intention, was just to go hang out with my pastor as he was talking to this guy. Somehow I got into the line. And so my pastor gets finished, and here I am. Me and this guy, famous pastor. I'm just looking at him, shakes my hand, and I say these words. I say, I'm with this guy. And I turn away, and I walk out. And to this day, I hope he doesn't remember me, ever. It was a very traumatic experience in my life, as I thought, that was my opportunity. I love these guys. You know, there's a stardom for me in some of this stuff, and I'm like, just didn't come out right. And so I should have planned my words. He told me, he gave me plenty of warning. I'm going to go up talk to this guy, and in my mind, should have realized, you're probably going to have to say a few words. You need to be ready. I didn't. It was terrible. How much more should we be careful in how we speak to God? Because the idea of hasty here is being, it's actually being manipulative to God in prayer. This comes from having a low view of God with selfish motives. See, God, he's not some spiritual magic genie that can be swayed by rash prayer. This word, do not be hasty in word, it gives a sense of threatening God to get what he wants. God, you do this, or else. How arrogant. How foolish. This phrase, hasty in speech, it's connected with being impulsive in heart. If you see that there, the connection between the heart and the mouth, once again, characterizing a fool. Luke 6:45 says, the good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth what is good, and the evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth what is evil, for his mouth speaks from that which fills his heart. The hasty heart causes the rash words to flow from the fool's mouth. You see that connection. Matthew 6:5, Jesus says, when you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites. Why? For they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners. Why? So that they may be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. You see how the words coming out of the mouth are with the intention of their heart. That's why they're standing on the street corners and doing that. A fool's prayers are self-absorbed because they are coming from an unregenerate heart. Matthew 23, verse 27, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside are full of dead man's bones and uncleanness. So you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. You see, false worship of the lips stems from these kinds of hearts. That's what Solomon's saying. Purpose for why our words are to be few in the presence of God is seen at the end of verse 2. That word for indicates a reason. For God is in heaven and you are on earth. God is in heaven, but we are on earth. God is intrinsically holy and transcendent, and we are stained by the curse of sin and dependent. We are merely created beings in the presence of an infinitely uncreated holy God. That's his purpose. There is a sharp and distinct contrast between us and God. The sooner we all learn that and accept that and kind of wallow in that, the better our lives will be. There is a God and we are not him. Right? He is not our homeboy. He is not our genie in a bottle. He is not just someone who is just another common friend. He is not to be approached lightly or treated tritely or worshipped falsely. But he is absolutely holy. He is unquestionably fierce. He is completely independent from everything else. He is perfectly righteous. He is innately good. And he is awesome beyond measure. Therefore, Solomon says at the end of verse 2, let your words be few. Let them be few. See, the one who fears God understands this because he has come to him on the basis of Christ's shed blood on his behalf. He has been covered with the righteousness of Christ and has a right understanding of who God is. That's the person who understands this. You know, as the song asks, are you washed in the blood? In the soul-cleansing blood of the Lamb. Are your garments spotless? Are they white as snow? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Because that is the only way you can approach God in the manner that we are commanded to approach God. You can never approach God outside of the blood of Christ. Well, verse 3, Solomon, he gives an analogy here to explain what a fool's words are like. Because you look at verse 3, it's kind of a weird verse. For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words. So what he is saying is excessive work can lead to being so tired that one loses touch with reality. Have you ever had that happen? Have you ever worked so tirelessly during the day that when you lay down, you're kind of in and out of sleep, and then when you are sleeping, you have the strangest dreams you've ever had in your life? Have you ever experienced that? And you wonder, what'd I eat? That's all I was wondering. I'm like, what'd I have today? Because you need to probably shelf that for a while. Sometimes you can be so tired, you can put in so much work, and you lay down and you're just exhausted. And you think, I'm just going to close my eyes, I'm going to have the best night's sleep ever. But you're in and out, and then you have these wild dreams. That's kind of what Solomon is saying here. He said, by way of analogy, the fool is so foolish that he thinks he will be able to gain favor and perhaps even manipulate God through his many words. So the more I talk to you, God, in this way, the more I try and threaten you, so to speak, the more I am hasty to you, the more I'm going to be able to get what I want. That's how the fool thinks. He doesn't understand the reality of who God is. Speech to God should come from nothing less than a heart that is in full submission to him, having first listened with the intention to obey him completely, and from a mouth that has cautiously considered the one with whom it is going to speak. Finally, a God-fearing worshiper is one who is committed in his vows to God. He is committed in his vows to God in verses 4 through 6. Verse 4 is nearly a direct quotation of Deuteronomy 23, where Moses is giving instruction to the nation concerning the implication of vows. Beginning of verse 4 is a temporal phrase, meaning that it signifies that the verbal action to follow is not a command to do all the time, but when it does happen, there's specific action that may result. So when you make a vow to God, he's not commanding that we make vows to God, but when you make a vow to God, if you make a vow to God, then there's a command that goes along with that. Do not be late in paying that vow. Vows are interesting, right? They were a significant part of Israel's worship. There were a lot of vows that the nation of Israel would take to God. And they would say they would commit to these different things. And so Solomon is saying that if you do that, he's not saying that there's no command in the first part of this. He's not saying you have to vow to God. But if you do vow to God, when you make a vow to God, you've got to keep that vow. It was not to be taken lightly. Our closest understanding of this is probably the marriage vow. Now, unfortunately, this is taken very lightly, but this fits into this category of what Solomon is talking about here. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it. When you stand before that significant other and you say, I do, you better follow through. That's the closest example we have to what Solomon is saying here. But it was a big part of their worship. Taking a vow meant this. It meant to bind someone, bind oneself with what proceeds from one's mouth. Right? You hear the statement, to be a man of your word, to be a woman of your word, means what you say is what you're going to do. That's what's being commanded here in terms of your expression to God, in terms of your commitments to God, is you bind yourself with what proceeds from your mouth. We have an example of a hasty vow. Like I said, they made all kinds of vows in the Old Testament, but there's an example of a hasty vow that the more I read this, the more I'm just kind of overwhelmed by this text. In Judges chapter 11, Jephthah. What was this guy thinking? Here's how we know that vows were a big part, because he did vow this, and this was just kind of what he did. He was the leader of Israel at this time, right? He was the judge. And he makes this crazy vow. Verse 29, now the Spirit of the Lord, this is what's so wild. Now the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. That's a weird thing, because what happens doesn't seem like that's the Spirit of the Lord. So that he passed through Gilead, Manasseh, and he passed through Mizpah and Gilead, and from Mizpah and Gilead he went to the sons of Ammon. And what did he do? He made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. Was he commanded to do that? Is there ever a place we see that you were commanded to tell God that kind of thing? No. And we don't know what kind of vow this was. Just the words in English as you read them. I didn't take the time to look at this in Hebrew, this part. But just the words when you hear that, doesn't it sound a little bit like manipulation? God, do this and I'm going to do this for you. I don't think that's exactly what it was. I think it was, in a sense, coming from a heart of worship. But this was a very hasty vow. And then what happens? It's the weirdest thing. So he crossed over. God gives the Ammonites into his hand. Verse 34, when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. Now she was his one and only child. Besides her, there was no son or daughter. Bizarre story. What did you feel like you needed to do? Kept the vow. There's a lot of debate. I think it's stupid. There's a lot of debate that says that she actually didn't die, but I think he went and he sacrificed his daughter, because you look at verse 38 or verse 39. He said, at the end of the 2 months, she said, let me go to the mountains and weep over my virginity. She wasn't married. At the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which he had made. That was a bad vow. I don't think you should make those kind of vows. And that's why a psalm is saying, when you make a vow, not you have to make a vow. I'm still baffled by that whole story. And in God's providence, it's in the Bible, in the book of Judges. I think it's showing how depraved the Israelites were at that time. That even in their leadership, there were these kind of things going on. But that was a bad vow. But what Solomon is saying is that if you make a vow, if you commit to do something for God, you are commanded to carry it out through to completion, to finish it, to accomplish it, to achieve it. So you got to be careful what you vow. You got to be careful how you approach God. You got to be careful how you think to God. Now Jephthah should have never killed his daughter. it was a stupid vow, and he should not have gone through with it. I'm not convinced that is the whole point of that thing. I don't think he should have, but that's how serious, the point is, that's how serious they thought of vows. Does that make sense? God never commanded human sacrifice. He tested Abraham with the thought of it. Never commanded it. That was a pagan thing. And so for him to carry through, that whole thing was just, it was a bad way of thinking. It was a bad situation. But that just shows how committed they were to their vows. And it plays into what Solomon is saying here in terms of how we are to approach God, that when you make a vow to God, you are to fulfill it. So let's bring it down to us. If you promise to serve God in some area in the church, fulfill your commitment to God. It's a serious thing. God doesn't take lightly for you to sign up and, I'm going to do this, and then, not going to do this. Don't do that. When you're going to come and serve God, remember it's God. That he is the infinitely holy God, and that he wants you to serve him. You believe this is what you're supposed to do, and so you're going to come and you're going to serve him whatever way you're going to serve him. Don't come into that lightly. Think about that, pray about that, and come in and say, yeah, I'm going to serve in this way. And then, do it. The church is full of people who say, I'm going to do this, and they don't do anything. Don't do that. God doesn't honor that. And we see that in our text. He doesn't honor that. So we see a purpose clause there at the end. Indicates that not fulfilling commitments is what characterizes fools, and that God does not delight, it says. It says, do not be late in paying it. Why? Because he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. Don't do it. Don't take a hasty vow. This idea of delight, God's delight is a word, it means God's kind disposition, an emotional or a joyful attitude. He doesn't have that in fools. God does not show delight to a fool who makes good, who doesn't make good on his vow. And in contrast, God's delight is upon the one who fears him and obeys in light of that worshipful fear. That's whom God delights in. Further explanation is given in verse 5. There are two absolute prohibitions in this verse, which emphasize the importance of one keeping their vow before God. It is not to be taken lightly. So you look at verse 6, it prohibits our mouths from causing our bodies to sin. Do not let your speech cause you to sin. That's the first thing it prohibits. And if you commit to do something in the presence of God and fail on that commitment, you are living in sin. Again, take it back to the marriage example. When you commit to that person, all of those things before God in that very sacred ceremony, and you don't fulfill what you are telling that person you are going to do in the presence of God, you are living in sin. That's just an example. Same thing in the church. Commit to God, I'm going to do this, I'm going to serve you in this way, I'm going to do this, and you don't fulfill it. You're actually living in sin because you're not keeping your commitment to God. That's how serious the vow is. That's how he has prescribed this. And certainly don't come to God's ordained leaders, as it says there in verse 6. Don't say in the presence of the messenger of God, that's God's ordained leaders, and we see that in Malachi 2 and Haggai 1, and complain that you have mistakenly made this commitment. So don't do that either. You are to take the time. You are to be intentional in the way that you think and the way you plan and what you do. Backing out of your commitment and counting it as a mistake or treating it tritely will give God a reason to be angry and to destroy your work. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? Don't give God that opportunity. Fulfill what you vow. This ties into the first and second points. By not approaching God in a haphazard manner and not rashly uttering prayers and commitments to God, God expects commitments made to him to be fulfilled. So are you fulfilling the commitments you have made to God? Are you fulfilling the commitments you made to God? Are there some commitments that you have been failing to keep and need to complete? Things to think through. Well, the conclusion of our text is beautifully built in because Solomon waits until this point to bring the main point of this text to bear on the lives of his readers. Here Solomon concludes his instructions concerning worship in verse 7 and gives us the very point clearly. He again repeats, for in many dreams there are many words and there's emptiness. By way of analogy, explaining that to do all of this without God is an emptiness. It is worthless. And then he gives us the point. He sums up his contrast between false worship and true worship. The character of a fool produces false, empty, meaningless worship, which is unacceptable to God because he doesn't belong to God. But the one who fears God is able to bring acceptable worship to him. And the context clarifies that the type of fear here, because that's what he says. He says, rather, in verse 7, fear God. Fearing God can indicate terror, respect, or worship. And the context, I think, clarifies that the type of fear demanded here is obedience, as it is in the context of worship. And this is a proper understanding of God's sovereignty, which brings proper worship, demonstrated by an obedient life, demonstrated by wise decision-making, demonstrated by loving wisdom and turning away from evil, and humility and trust and satisfaction and reverence and fulfillment and eternal life as the reward. That's what fear in God means. The fear of God in the Old Testament that is demanded in order to properly worship is the reality of salvation. It's the reality of salvation. The entire purpose of this book hinges on the phrase at the end of verse 7. Fear God. Fearing God is the key to living a life of fulfillment to the glory of God. The only way that we can fear God and thus properly worship through the cross is through the cross. And have you come to the cross? Have you come to the cross? And if you have, are you living in a way that displays your fear of God, your reverence of Him, your awe of Him, especially when you come to worship Him? Well, may our worship of God be proper, and may it reflect hearts that fear Him. Let's pray. Father, thank You for Your grace and Your mercy. And Lord, that though we fail You often, we fail in our commitments on a daily basis at times, that Your grace is enough and it is sufficient to sustain us even in our weaknesses. Father, just help us to contemplate how we are to come to You because of who You are. Lord, may our hearts be lifted before Your throne because we have a higher view of God, knowing Your infinite, eternal, transcendent qualities that make You who You are. We want to worship You rightly. In Jesus' name, amen.